This is another iRaw podcast.
So what's going on here, I think, is that on the surface, people say, okay, well, this needs to be about animals. We're diluting the message. Okay, that's a very simplistic approach. But I think if we actually dig down into it, what it's doing is actually disrupting hierarchies of power. It's disrupting male entitlement, white entitlement to the public sphere, getting to speak on behalf of the movement. And so right away, like, we have to think about, if we have a movement that's not actually enacting the type of world we want to live in, how effective is it going to be?
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Animal Tone podcast. This is season 6, where we're focusing in on animals and politics. And today I'm going to be speaking to Dr. Corey Wren about two concepts that are interrelated, but I could have arguably spoken about these concepts separately. But I think that having them together in this episode has been really quite fascinating and interesting. So today we're talking about social movement mobilization, as well as feminism. And they come in and out of the frame and a variety of different ways over the course of the interview. So Dr. Corey Wren is a lecturer of sociology with the School of Social Policy, Sociology, and Social Research, and she's the co-director of the Center for the Study of Social and Political Movements at the University of Kent. She received her PhD in sociology with Colorado State University in 2016 and was awarded Exemplary Diversity Scholar in 2016 by the University of Michigan's National Center for Institutional Diversity. Corey served as a council member with the American Sociological Association, Animals and Society section, and was elected chair in 2018. She also co-founded the International Association of Vegan Sociologists in 2020. Corey serves as a book review editor for the Society and Animals, consulting editor for the Psychology of Human-Animal Intergroup Relations, and an editor for the Sociological Quarterly. She has done a whole host of work. She is a prolific author. We speak about several of her books over the course of the interview. She has been the host of a podcast called Sociology and Animals Podcast, and she has been published in several peer-reviewed academic journals, including the Journal of Gender Studies, Environmental Values, and Feminist Media Studies. In July 2013, Corey founded the Vegan Feminist Network, an academic activist project engaging in intersectional social justice praxis. She is the author of A Rationalist Approach to Animal Rights, Extensions in Abolitionist Theory, as well as Piecemeal Protest, Animal Rights in the Age of Nonprofits, and Animals in Irish Society. There is forthcoming two really interesting books, which we speak a little bit about towards the end of the episode, called Vegan Witchcraft, Contemporary Magical Practice and Multi-Species Social Change, which sounds so interesting. She just gave a little tidbit about Halloween, and immediately I was like, ah! So I'm really excited for this book to come out. And in the future, there will also be a book called Vegan Feminism, History, Theory, and Activism. So we touch on a whole host of these concepts and ideas throughout the episode today. And I'm really delighted that these were included in the season on animals and politics because, you know, thinking about animal rights as a political movement is kind of central, I think, to this season. And thinking about how that movement has mobilized over time is an essential part of understanding the politics of animals and how animals are included or not in our societies. So I hope you enjoy. All right. Hi, Corey. Welcome to the Animal Tone podcast.
Hello. Welcome. I messed up.
That's from your podcasting skills.
Well, no, I just came out of a conference last weekend where I was hosting it. So I can start over.
Nope, that's fine. I think it's quite funny. How are you today?
I am okay. I just got out of class and it's Friday the 13th. And so as it's being recorded, just looking forward to some spooky season.
Yeah, I'm really delighted that it's Friday as well. So Corey, today I'm hoping that we're going to speak a bit about, I think, two fields that you know deeply, and we'll see how we do and how deeply we get into either of them. But I was hoping to talk to you a bit about feminism on the one hand, and on the other hand, social movement mobilization. And I suspect they're quite interrelated and under the kind of broader banner of politics. So why should scholars who are interested in animals and politics be interested in feminism and be interested in social movement mobilization? But perhaps before we get into that, you are pretty big in both of these fields. You could tell us a little bit about yourself and your research.
Oh, gosh. I don't know where to begin because I have so many projects going on right now. It's a bit ridiculous. But yeah, I think you did well to choose those topics to have me come and speak about, because if I had to summarize in two camps, the main things that I do, that would be feminism and social movement politics. Actually, I came into feminism a little bit later. I was trained as a social movement scholar, and it was only when I was a PhD student and I started teaching a gender class that I realized, wow, there's a lot here that could inform social movement stuff and the animal rights movement, rather. And that's when I started to introduce that as part of my social movement, you know, expertise. And the pushback that I got from that, from the activist community, was pretty shocking. And then I realized that I'm never just going to be a gender neutral social movement scholar. I'm going to have to take on feminism full force, because although we had Carol Adams and Greta Garde and Lori Groon and Marty Keel and all the other amazing vegan feminist authors, it seems that they were a bit stuck in analog, and not a lot of that had been moved into the new digital wave of animal rights activism. And so I started in 2013 a blog, back when blogs were a lot more influential than they are now. But I started a blog called Vegan Feminist Network, which was not just myself, but I had a lot of other people publishing on that. People like Cheryl Abate, who's now like a major animal ethics philosopher, AFCO, who everyone knows now. So we started off back then because we knew that there was a lot more happening on the margins than the animal activist movement was really ready to acknowledge. So when I say that I'm in these two camps of feminist theory and social movement theory, really they overlap heavily. It's hard to actually untangle those. So I guess that would be me in a nutshell. I'm just interested in, and really I got into social movement theory because I've been a vegan for most of my life, animal rights activist as long as I can remember.
What was your journey to veganism?
Yeah, well, okay. So I'm from Appalachia. I don't know if anyone can pick up my accent, but I came from a place where veganism was not known at all. Vegetarianism was also quite foreign. And I just was always one of those people who was especially empathetic when it came to other animals. I always had animals around me, all kinds of pets. I hate that word and the institution, but that's what I grew up with, lots of pets, mice, hamsters, even salamanders and cats and dogs and all of that. And I can still remember some of my first protests as a little kid, like actually getting involved. But it wasn't until I was about 13 that I was watching a cooking show with my mom, and the cook went to go to a butcher shop to pick up some ingredients, body parts really. And in the shot, as he entered the butcher shop, you could see pigs' heads hanging from chains up front. And it was just that jarring image, that morally shocking image, just had me think like, okay, these ingredients are actually persons. And I remember telling my mom, like, that's it, I'm going vegetarian. And she says, oh yeah, well, we'll see. And I sometimes wonder if that part of it actually kind of, that I had to be obstinate about it. I'm like, oh, sure. Yeah. But yeah, I went vegetarian. It was difficult on my parents because we grew up really, really working class. We didn't always have a lot of money. I was on a free lunch program at school, so sometimes I just had French fries, you know. But I knew pretty quickly that veganism was the way I needed to go. This is the 90s, by the way, the early 90s, mid-90s, I guess. And we didn't have internet. So I wrote to PETA, which is in the middle of nowhere, Appalachia. At least I knew about PETA. So I wrote them a handwritten letter, and they sent me back a bunch of magazines and literature and things like that. And that's where I learned about animal testing. That's where I learned about dairy and all that sort of thing. And I wanted to go vegan right away, but I just knew it was going to be too difficult with my family. So I said, the day I move out, the day I go to university is the day I go vegan. And that was August of 2001. So for me, it's been a major part of my life. I'm turning 40 next week. Gulp. So I've been vegan most of my life. So for me, it was never really, you know, why should someone go vegan? I felt like there's a lot of people doing that type of work. I wanted to know, okay, I'm already vegan. We've got a lot of people who've been vegan. We've got an animal rights movement that's been around for 100 plus years. I'm more interested in how to make that movement more effective. And so that's where I came in as a social movement scholar. I mean, I started out when I went to university, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just took classes that were interesting to me. And at the end of the day, I turned around and said, wow, it looks like I have a political science degree with a minor in sociology. Okay. And then I ended up in sociology for a master's, which was, there was a lot of choices I wanted to take. I actually just went with sociology. It was a matter of convenience because of where the university was located. And then When I got to my PhD, it was a matter of, I started to realize then that I wanted to do something about animals because as a master's student, I did not know you could study animals at all in sociology. I was not aware that there were people like David Nybert, Jessica Greenbaum, and others, Leslie Irvine, who were doing this work. So I went with the environmental sociology focus, and I did my master's on Appalachian environmental injustice. But then when I went to do my PhD, I realized I'd actually been spending a lot of time as the president of the Animal Rights Club as a master's student. So this is where my passion is. This is where my passion is. So I started to push back and see if I could actually introduce that into my PhD work. And I got a lot of resistance. I got a lot of resistance from the faculty, unfortunately. I chose Colorado State University because it is an environmental sociology program, and it focuses on food justice, green stuff. So I went there and was actually quite shocked that animal agriculture is a leading cause of climate change. And as sociologists, we purport to care about social justice. And yet nobody in my department was studying animal issues. And I don't think anyone was vegan. Maybe a couple of people were vegetarian for environmental reasons, but it was just like such a disconnect. And then I realized, you know, not only now I have two missions. One mission, of course, is to use sociology in the service of social movements. But the other mission is to then take social justice activism and put it in the service of sociology, because sociology itself has a long way to go. So that's kind of my journey.
What's interesting about what you said there, I think, in your kind of field of study, social movement mobilization, is I think a lot of people maybe think of, you know, animal rights activism or veganism as being relatively contemporary, but it's not. It's got a really long history. Like you said, at least 150 years, people have been fighting for this. So this then suggests to me that this hasn't really been a very successful social movement, at least in terms of its ability to mobilize and affect, you know, substantive change, especially when you start to consider that more animals are dying now than ever before. Do you think that that's a fair assessment? And if so, what do you think kind of explains this failure to mobilize on behalf of animals?
I think it depends on what time of the day you catch me when you ask me a question like that. I think I can definitely fall into the camp where this is just hopeless. You know, everybody talks about the movement, you talk about just wish you could push that button and end all of it, because it's just the magnitude of suffering is so extreme. And every day in my line of work, every day I learn about some new horrible thing that's happening to some species of animals. And it's so disheartening. On the other hand, as someone who has been studying social movements, specifically the animal rights movement, I can say that there's been significant gains. I think one that's happened recently that still, I step back and I'm just like, how did we even get here? This is so astonishing. It's the plant-based university campaign that's happening in the United Kingdom. So as an American, like, I thought the veganism and animal rights had made some headway in the United States. But when I moved to Britain, started working at the University of Kent, it's a whole other ballgame, because obviously this is the heart of the vegan movement, and it's had a longer time to germinate. But the normalization of vegan here is so much more. It's astounding. And so this campaign that Animal Rising has launched, and it's got issues, it's been criticized for not actually centering animals. There's lots of debates we could go into with that. But what I will say about this particular campaign, they work with universities in the UK, and they ask students to take advantage of student democratic channels in order to push more radical, I guess, campus policies. So the idea is that if we know, in universities, we know, we're the people who are creating the knowledge, informing public policy, we know that animal agriculture is a leading cause of climate change. Why is it that the university is still so invested in animal agriculture? And so these students will use the democratic channels. They go through the student unions and say, actually, we're requesting that you disinvest from that. And we're asking that you actually, at the very least, begin by transitioning your catering on campus to completely 100% plant-based. So that, I remember when two of my students came up to me a year and a half ago and said, we want to launch this campaign at the University of Kent. And I said, in my mind, well, to their face, I was like, I'm so happy that you're doing this. I will support you in any possible way. And I, you know, did everything I could. In my mind, I was like, good luck. This will never work. But who am I to say that? Who am I to say that? Because if there's energy, that's one thing that unfortunately I think I've noticed post-COVID is there is a real lack of energy and encouragement and enthusiasm with students nowadays. It's really taken a hit on student social life and political life. So when I have students who are like geared up and want to do something like that, I'm like, by all means, go for it. But I didn't think it'd be successful. And here I am a year and a half later, and I can proudly say that the University of Kent is joining several other British universities in transitioning to 100% plant-based within this decade, in the next few years. So that to me, I think, yeah, it tells you though that something's happening here, because when I was a university student, we were lucky. I remember being at Virginia Tech and how grateful I was when I went to the cafeteria and they had cheeseless pizza there with like onion on it or whatever. And wow, there's a vegan option. I thought it was great. Now we're like, okay, we're making it all plant-based and not just, you know, for no reason, but because we're seeing it as a political issue. And the idea here is that universities will become a cultural sort of beacon, a cultural leader. So it'll be really exciting to see what happens next. And of course, we've also seen other laws and legislation and policies and things that have been aimed at animals. But I think that's where I get a little skeptical, because a lot of those laws, unfortunately, have had the effect of only streamlining and normalizing animal oppression. And this is something that activists realized even back in the 1880s with the first animal welfare law that was intended for animals in vivisection.
So I think Animal Rising is a really good example of a kind of successful, I think, campaign to mobilize around a specific issue. And I think they've made use of, you mentioned there that they've perhaps been criticized for not positioning animals, because, and I think one of the reasons that they've been so successful is that they've positioned this as a climate change issue. And I think it is a climate change issue, and they're not wrong to do that. And I've mentioned several times on the podcast myself that I've been disillusioned at universities or working with climate change scientists who haven't made the connection to animal agriculture. And I find it really disheartening where the institutions that are supposedly the places that generate the knowledge to affect change are actually perpetuating a lot of the inequalities and the problems that we see in the world. They're like microcosms of some of the bigger issues we see in our societies. So I think And I think it's really, you have to actually live and do the change you hope for. And I think the fact that universities are going more plant-based is a really, it's a big step in terms of changing norms, changing how we can practice things differently. But I do think, though, like, what does it say about the strategy of kind of sidelining animals in these campaigns? I know Will Kimlicker wrote an opinion piece, I don't know, a year or two ago, calling veganism the orphans on the left, that a lot of social movements will support one another. Feminist movements will often support black rights movements. Black rights movements will often support disability movements. A variety of different movements will support one another, but somehow animal rights or veganism seems to be outside of that. Why do you think that is? And or do you think that's a fair assessment? Do you think that animal rights or veganism is an orphan on the left? And if so, why do you think so?
I think yes and no. I think that increasingly I am seeing animal rights and veganism recognized by other movements. For instance, I went to the Extinction Rebellion protest for Earth Day in London this year, so April 2023, and it was the largest environmental protest in English history. And there was a whole section of the march that was just for animal rights. And the food for sale there was vegan. And so it was kind of there. It was there. I think the thing is that veganism is still considered quite radical. It's considered like the radical fringe of the movement, which of course we're changing that, but it's still considered, I think, for other movements, the radical fringe of the movement. So what a lot of movements will say is like, they care about animals. They love animals. Animals matter. They may mention animals a little bit in their claims making, but the veganism bit, maybe that's the extreme stuff. So maybe not adopting that as much. I do think that is changing. So right now I'm working on some vegan feminist research, for instance, and I'm looking at some of the eco-feminist folks from the 70s and the 80s, and they'll mention, and I've never seen, in some of the stuff I'm looking at, I've never seen any mention of animal rights, but they will talk about how they care about animals, and then they'll see the recipes that are included in like activist flyers will be vegan. They'll not flag them as vegan, but they'll just be vegan. So it's like, it's there. It's just, it needs time. I think that one of the other reasons, and I think F. Coe has written quite a lot about this in her second book, Racism as Zoological Witchcraft, if anybody wants to learn more about this. But I think another aspect here is this concept of animality. So if we're looking at social justice movements around identity politics, women historically have been seen as animals, politically treated as animals, people of color, lower class people, people with disabilities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, historically have been understood as animals or legally even treated as animals. And so there is a hesitancy, I'm sure, to fully embrace non-human animals, because the idea is that for a lot of those movements is they're trying to prove their humanity and access human rights. So for instance, kind of funny, I was just came from the library on the way to here, and I was looking in the feminist section, and there was a book by Catherine McKinnon, who's a very famous legal feminist scholar from the late 20th century. And there was a book, it was called, Are Women Human Yet? And then there's a little chapter in the middle there, like, are women human yet? And so she was going through all the different reasons mm-hmm. that women are still objectified. They are get all these awful harms and injustices and no legal rights and da, 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 da. But what she means there is that, you know, we need to fight for human rights. And so this idea that humanity is equated with recognition and protection. So why on earth would these movements then want to actively embrace their animality? Well, of course, that's where it gets good. Because the second we start to upturn animality as something bad, when we take away animality as some negative comparison point, well, we take away that place to put people who are oppressed. We challenge that oppressive logic when we challenge speciesism. Speciesism, I would argue, being the very root of all oppressions.
It's interesting. I think I'm happy you brought up a kind of intersectionality there, because, yeah, I sometimes worry, I guess, when we talk about intersectionality, that folks just say intersectionality without necessarily grappling with thinking through how we are really positioned differently and how it greatly shapes our lives quite differently. But I understand the fear that adding species might dilute the gains made. However, when you add species and you add something like feminism, you start to think about the female body in very different ways. So you start to think about things like menstruation or reproduction very differently. And you realize, I know that you've got a blog entry where you speak about, you know, human women aren't the only ones that menstruate. And we're certainly not the only ones that give birth. We're not the only mammals that give birth. And in fact, how reproduction has been mobilized in agriculture is a feminist issue. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about why, I guess, feminism is really important to having a conversation about speciesism, a word I can never say, and why it is really politically important that we think about feminism.
Yeah, so I think that, obviously I'm not the first person to come up with these ideas. This is a long conversation that reaches back all the way to the 1800s. But I was just reading, and I highly recommend this, I was just reading the second version, the second edition, the updated version of Carol Adams and Lori Gruen's edited book called Ecofeminism. And in the second edition, they really go into, in the first chapter, and I assigned this to my students in environmental politics because it was just so good. But they really go into the history of how feminism kind of got sidelined in the animal rights movement and in the late 20th century and how it kind of continues today. We have actively resistant men who are really worried about the trope of this. It's really interesting in the chapter they trace how this became this trope of the little old lady in tennis shoes, which basically disparages older women, disparages women in the public sphere. And the idea was we want to respond to this idea that caring about animals is super feminine and as though that's a bad thing and woo-woo. And so we have all these scholars coming out of the 20th century, especially the Oxford Club, like the Oxford group, like Peter Singer, Richard Ryder, trying to make this a rational sort of agenda. So let's get rid of all that woo-woo feminist stuff and make it about rational discourse and reason. But unfortunately, what that's done is had a really chilling effect on the animal rights movement for people who are now, you know, active in the 21st century. There's quite a lot of gender neutrality to the way we do our activism or active resistance to feminism. And by the way, when I'm saying feminism, it's not just, you know, women's issues. Feminism tends to encompass other issues as well, like looking at race, ethnicity, age, class, et cetera, et cetera. Just to give you an example, F. Coe, bless her, she some years ago wrote a piece for the Vegan Society on her website, which I'm not sure if she still runs it anymore, but it's called Black Vegans Are Cool or something like that. All it did was spotlight Black people doing vegan stuff. It was just straightforward as that. But just the idea that Black people were going to spotlight Blackness in a movement that's supposed to be about animals pissed people off. And the Vegan Society had posted it on their Facebook page, and the onslaught of comments that came underneath it was just truly shocking. And it knocked AFF back. I mean, AFF has been around the block and is ready for that kind of stuff. But to see that kind of visceral response to just saying Black people exist in the vegan movement. So that's what we're dealing with. It's not just like this kind of backlash against feminism. It's also a backlash against, you know, all kinds of multicultural bits. So I think right there that the fact that people are get so upset about it is an indication to kind of dig down in there. Where there's fear, there's power somewhere. So let's uncover that. So what's going on here, I think, is that, well, on the surface, people say, okay, well, this needs to be about animals. We're diluting the message. Okay, that's a very simplistic approach. But I think if we actually dig down into it, what it's doing is actually disrupting hierarchies of power. It's disrupting male entitlement, white entitlement to the public sphere and getting to speak on behalf of the movement. And so right away, like, we have to think about, if we have a movement that's not actually enacting the type of world we want to live in, how effective is it going to be? So this is a bit I want to talk about, because I know Carol Adams has done so much work on the, you know, vegetarian politics of, you know, sex and gender and all that sort of stuff. And we think of, you know, as you mentioned, there's a lot of correlations between what happens to animal bodies and what happens to women's bodies. But I think we also need to start looking about how these gender politics also transpire within the animal rights movement. That's the next frontier, I think, that needs our attention, because that is still highly contentious. I don't know many people who come across Carol Adams' sexual politics of meat thesis and say, that's crap. All right, we've kind of accepted that, all right? But the unfortunate bit is that book has become so seminal that most people have been at least familiar with the basic idea, that now I think most people think, okay, I've been exposed to the vegan feminist argument, I got it, next. And therefore I'm somehow above any type of criticism and don't feel the need to have any self-reflection. So then actually those gender politics are allowed to flourish in a very toxic way in the animal rights movement. Just to give you another example, here in the UK, we have an event called Vegan Campout. Vegan Campout is the biggest vegan gathering in the whole of Britain. Basically, it happens every summer and all the people go and they camp and they have speakers and workshops and things like that. And I've been living in the UK for 5 years now, and I've not once gone, because every time I see what the lineup is, and by the way, I have lots of vegan buddies who would love to go camp there, but I'm like, it's not for me. Why? Because I see the lineup every year is exactly the same. Men, 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 men. What? One woman, men, 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 one non-binary person, thwing. Men, 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 men. It's the great men show, right? And it's like, is this 1860? Like back when the RSPCA was blocking women from being participants in the animal rights movement and having any leadership or sway or entry in the public sphere? Because that's what it looks like. It looks like the 19th century to me. And so I made it like a casual comment on Vegan Feminist Network earlier this year about that. And the vegan campout people snarked back at me and basically accused me of being sexist, of course, because how dare I point out the obvious that they have no women speaking for their events. And then known abusers like Russell Brand, a known abuser. Like, there's no secret about it. It's just now come out in the media because a documentary has come out. But we've all known he's been a sexual abuser. When he got made the lead speaker for the vegan campout, that was no secret then either, right? So that also has ramifications. Like, it's not just we're ignoring women's voices, we're also putting women in danger, because the side effect of celebrating men's voices and sidelining women is that it becomes a very scary place where you have a highly feminized movement and there's a lot of women there. But unfortunately, in a feminized space, in sociology, we call this the glass escalator. Whoop. So where women tend to experience a glass ceiling, they can only rise up so high due to invisible barriers. When men enter feminized spaces, they tend to experience the opposite effect. Because they are men, they're seen to be more relatable, more interesting, more legitimate, more convincing, whatever it may be. And so that's why we have this kind of draw to these male celebrities. But that becomes very dangerous then when you have men taking advantage of that power and exploiting women, harassing women, doing worse to women, actually harming women, or just plagiarizing them. Like, that happens to me all the time. So one of the things that's great about having a first name is Corey. It's still kind of a masculine name. So like, people would maybe think twice before they start stealing it, but people steal my work all the time. So
that's really interesting. So it sounds to me like one of the reasons why scholars, at least, you know, scholars who are interested in animal studies should be interested in kind of feminism, or scholars that are interested in politics and animal studies should be interested in feminism, is one, because feminism or animal bodies are gendered bodies. The ways in which they're positioned in industries is shaped by their gender, right? How a bull is treated and how a cow are treated in the milk industry are vastly different to one another. So sex and gender shape their experiences, but also because gender and gender relations have been so central to power relations, at least, have been so central to how the history of the vegan and the feminist movement in general, but also the history of the vegan movement, how much, you know, female thought has been sidelined. And now how, you know, you mentioned Carol Adams, for example, Ellen and Laurie Gruen. And it's interesting because I know ecofeminism was kind of, I don't know, I remember when researching feminism, ecofeminism was almost somehow seen also as an outlier of feminism, right? Ecofeminists were often viewed as kind of next to feminists who were looking at like political feminism just purely and not introducing the environment. They were viewed as a little bit more woo-woo. And it's really interesting to see how many times scholars who have been trying to bring together the politics of gender and the politics of environmental destruction are often sidelined. And now there's this moment when people are really recognizing and appreciating that they are intersecting. But yet again, oftentimes it's not women that are up on the stage having those conversations. So I think those are really, really important points for why feminism is important. And also, just to go back to the idea of social movement mobilization, why perhaps some folks are reluctant, maybe, you know, you mentioned there how sometimes vegan activists or vegans can get really vitriolic online and say really like horrible things. And I think a lot of people can do this. Online is like a gross space. But I wonder if sometimes vegans who get bitchy and nasty and horrible and dickish online, if they're not kind of somehow held to a higher, the whole movement gets wrapped on the knuckles because somehow a small group of people have been knobheads. Or am I just reducing and diminishing how big this problem is actually in the vegan movement?
I think your individualizing was actually a structural issue here, because that all social justice movements come across that sort of painting them to be whiny or cantankerous or violent or too rebellious or woo-woo or whatever, all kinds of pejoratives that have been dragged out. If you're challenging the status quo, if you're challenging power, that is one of the first things that they're going to drag out. And they will hype up. Like this, I have a blog post on this somewhere, I have to drag it out, but there's this myth, for instance, in the animal rights movement of the pure vegan. And we don't want to promote this idea of the pure vegan. Whoever, actually, I start to think about it, whoever was promoting the pure veganism thing, I don't remember anyone. Like, even the Vegan Society has the caveat of be vegan means to avoid animal products as much as practical and possible. And so then I realized, who's the one who kept saying this, that we need to be realistic and not paint ourselves as these purest vegans? I realized it was all these major animal welfare charities who are not animal rights related, right? They're using that, saying, oh, people, you know, you're basically creating a straw person argument. And so I think that what happens basically is when we're speaking truth to power, power pushes back and tries to create this image of us being nasty and whatever. It's the same deal with the state. If anybody has not seen this, do a Google search where you can see, like with the United States and Great Britain, the security guards, the border security people, they're trained to look for different organizations that vegans and animal rights activists might be associated with. And organizations like the Vegan Society are on there. Like, for Pete's sake, what kind of terrorist activity are they doing? Just trying to sell more stuff, right? They're not radical at all. But the idea is to paint us as terrorists. I mean, I was actually stopped in New Zealand because I was there for an animal rights conference. And I made the mistake of saying, I'm here for an animal rights conference. Right this way, madam. So I think that it's not so much what we're doing within the movement. There's a lot actually that's being, the narrative is being shaped from outside. Within the movement, I've also written quite a lot about this, like in my second book, talking about infighting. Infighting is normal to social movements. It's simply normal to social movements. But what I was kind of worried about there is that infighting is seen as not normal to social movements and something that should be manipulated and controlled or quelled in some way. But it's often the organizations with the power, the hegemonic organizations who control the field. They're the ones that say, you need to change. We're talking to the radicals. You need to change and stop being a jerk or too cantankerous or whatever else. And you need to quit being so purist and radical and da-da-da. They never listen. They would never say, let's stop the infighting by, oh, I don't know, promoting veganism so it doesn't piss people off in the first place. So what I'm asking them when we're talking about infighting is it's more than just this individual approach. Wow, so-and-so is just a jerk. There's always going to be a jerk, of course. But really, when we're talking about the politics of discourse and animal rights, and we're talking about and other social movements as well, we're talking about other more structural things that are in place, the counter movements, the state, compromised welfare organizations that are supposedly within our movement, which actually collude quite a bit with the state and industry. The industry, of course, they're also very much so trying to paint us as these radical, angry, dangerous people. So I want us to be very careful then when we start politicizing infighting amongst ourselves, because it's actually part of a larger kind of connection there. We're always going to have infighting. And guess what? Infighting has led to some of the most important developments in the animal rights movement. If we didn't have infighting, we would not be vegan. If we didn't have infighting, we would still have the RSPCA promoting hunting. If we didn't have infighting, we would still have major organizations, quote unquote, euthanizing healthy dogs and cats, which some organizations still do, but they're outed now and it's not okay to do it anymore. We challenge it quite a bit. It's infighting that has actually challenged all of those actually deeply speciesist practices that the animal rights movement made room for.
That's such an important point. And it makes me, to come back to feminism again, it makes me think of, I think, second wave feminism, right? Like feminists were like, yeah, I'm a woman, so I can speak on behalf of all women. And then women, and these are primarily women from, you know, the UK and the US, and then women in other parts of the world and of other colors. So like, wait, hang on, just because you're a woman, you can't speak. And that was an infight, I guess, in some ways within feminism that actually deepened feminism, made feminism more nuanced, made it more critical, showed how, you know, it seems like it's fracturing, but it's actually a maturation. So I think I take your point there. Something you just said there about kind of infighting, though, reminded me of a piece you wrote about, I think it was about flexitarianism, where you speak about the kind of radical politics versus conservative politics. And I thought this was quite interesting because you said at some point in this, you kind of said that you think this idea of incrementalization, like incremental change, is not really helping the political movement of achieving rights for animals or of getting into a better place. Could you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah. So this is, once again, I think it seems like a common sense issue. And yet when you start looking at, so a lot of this, by the way, a lot of this insight is coming from my second book where I looked at, did a content analysis, a discourse analysis, basically animal rights activism from the 1980s all the way up until maybe 10 years ago. And it was looking at who's saying what, basically. And again, it's a sort of reflection of that infighting debate where it's like, well, the world's not going to go vegan overnight, so we have to compromise some way. Well, I don't think anyone ever in the animal rights movement said the world will go vegan overnight if we say people go vegan. No one ever said that, right? There was always an assumption that change is going to be slow and incremental in some way. But that kind of false divide has been politicized by the major animal charities, the welfare charities that are not interested in animal liberation. They just work in making the system a little bit nicer to really for consumers, not really for animals. But they start to politicize that language and say, oh, yes, but if the world's not going to go vegan overnight, then let's adopt a flexitarian approach and they can gradually become vegan. But the catch is, if you start to look at that material, a lot of the time, there's no end goal to that. It's as though being a flexitarian is the goal in of itself. There is no end in sight where one day you would go towards being vegan. So that, I mean, if you did an incremental approach to veganism, that actually has some backing, psychological backing to it. If it's difficult for you to change overnight, like I went vegan overnight, but not everybody could do that and incrementally go towards it. Fine. There's a science to back that. However, these organizations are not actually doing that. They're just saying, okay, we'll cut back on whatever. And, you know, whatever you think is a flexitarian, that's what it is. And it would be the equivalent of saying if the feminist movement was saying, okay, we know that rape and sexual assault against women is terrible, but men, I know you may not be able to give up beating women and harming women overnight, but at least kind of cut down on it. The end goal would be stop doing it eventually, not to just, you know, don't punch women. You can still kick them, whatever you think a flexitarian is when it comes to abusing women. You know what I mean? It's like these organizations are actually just using this as a stopgap so that we don't have to question them anymore, because actually what they're doing, they are actually intentionally watering down their political approach, because they know that if they advocate for veganism, that is going to be a direct challenge to a lot of industries that put money into these foundations that fund these organizations and keep them in business. And that is not a secret. This is something I think that most activists don't know, but that's why they compromise. Not because of social science. There's no science to prove flexitarianism is going to work, or there's very limited science. And in fact, I would say it's quite contentious. Instead, what they're doing, what they know will work, is if they promote flexitarianism, they can guarantee they can still have access to their funds and their big grants. So they're not going to alienate conservative donors who have ties to speciesist industries.
Yeah, that's so important. And it reminds me of something Gary said in the previous interview when I was talking to him about abolition, Gary Francione. And he was kind of at pains to say that people who are talking about abolition tend to often be individuals or small collectives that are working towards abolition, and that you rarely kind of get abolition in these large organizations because they need kind of some sort of money, revenue, income. And it makes me think, you know, it operates, this kind of insidious watering down of your politics operates at so many different levels. There's institutional level, but I realized early on, you know, in my own vegan journey, I was quite shy, right, about my veganism. I didn't want to alienate others because of my choice. So I would say things like, you know, I'm plant-based, or do you have anything without meat or eggs? Like I would almost avoid using the vegan label. And then at some point I realized that the vegan label is much like the feminist label. It's a political label. And when I go into a restaurant and I ask, even if I know and I've looked at the menu and there's nothing on the menu that is vegan, it's important for me to ask, do you have anything vegan? Simply because it can be an alienating and a discomforting question for me and for the others involved, but there is something important in that discomfort, and trying to water down what my own politics are is watering for whose benefit? Like, for whose benefit is that watering down? And then, of course, this is operating at a very different kind of scale because institutions are doing this as well. And I think their minds are in the right place. I really do believe that these institutions want to help animals, but I find that your focus on is that effective and is that an effective strategy is really quite alluring.
I think there's definitely a capitalist element to this as well, because there's this idea that the bigger we get, the more resources we can accrue, the more successful we will be. But what a lot of these organizations won't or can't acknowledge is that actually working within the capitalist system has no hope of challenging the capitalist system. You're simply aligning with this machine. So there's not going to come a day when you're like, okay, we've earned enough money, now we can stop it or whatever. Like, no, you become subsumed into this capitalist system. And there's a lot of research on this, by the way. There's a really good book called The Revolution Will Not Be Funded, if people want to learn more about the politics of what happens when you become a professional charity. That was recommended to me by Breeze Harper like 10 years ago and changed the course of my research single-handedly with that one email. But anyway, the idea here is that, you know, people think that capitalism is going to get them out of these problems that were created by capitalism, but capitalism is smart. It can fill these cracks and these inconsistencies and these conflicts in these ways where basically you're absorbing in the enemy and making the enemy part of the system. And actually, you mentioned that you believe these people care. I'm not going to say that these people are evil and don't want animals to be helped. But I do believe that there is a socialization effect that happens when you enter into these organizations. There's a bureaucratization that happens, not just to your organization when you take this path, but to your own psyche. And you start to believe that. And then the insidious part of it is it starts to be pushed back into the grassroots movements. I can distinctly remember when I was a graduate student No, actually, I think I was still an undergraduate student. This is before I was president of the animal rights group at my university. I was, still an undergraduate. And there was, mind you, this is 20 some years ago, but there was a different university down the road that wanted to shift. They wanted our help. They emailed us and wanted us to help them with a campaign to shift to happy eggs. And the president of the club was like, yeah, all right, guys, let's get ready. We're going to go and help this student and like start a campaign. And I said, sorry, I'm vegan. I'm not in the business of promoting eggs. Like, why are we doing that? So why don't we just promote no eggs? Like, why don't we promote more vegan choices or something? And then he just like, I saw it in his eyes. Claudia, I saw it in his eyes. Like, boom. He just defaulted to this rhetoric that comes out of the big welfare organizations. Like, the world will not go vegan overnight, and we will have to get higher welfare products in the meantime. And it's like, you could just see how he'd been programmed. And then it dawned on me, indeed, because we went to school at Virginia Tech. Virginia Tech is only about 3 hours away from Washington, D.C., 5 hours away from Norfolk, where PETA used to be located, and where United Poultry Concerns today is a lot more abolitionist, I think, than it used to be. But anyway, these organizations, Compassion Over Killing, Farm Sanctuary, all of them, they would come down and do talks to the students, the grassroots groups, which would create the next generation of leaders in animal rights, like me today. Like I do it full time. Like that's where we come from. They know, they go to these universities and then talk with the student leaders that they're going to be able to groom the next generation of people to fall in line with this logic. So I think that there's a socialization effect that happens when an organization chooses to go professional. So many of these organizations that started off as student groups, like even PETA, Compassion Over Killing, which is now, what are they called now? That was considered too radical. So they've changed some generic crap. I'm sorry, it's generic because I've already forgotten it, because it's just non-offensive, non-threatening, non-radical, vegetarian, flexitarian, blah, blah, blah. But that's basically what's happening. These radical groups, and I think Compassion Over Killing, whatever they're called now, such a great example. If you go back and look, and I've documented it in my book, my second book, if you go back and look at their early student protest pamphlets they would put out, there's pictures on the front of their magazine of students getting arrested. And they were just like, yeah, they're so proud of it. And the magazine would be called The Abolitionist. But then when they went professional a few years later, gone were the old photocopied black and white student magazines. Now it's a glossy magazine. And it's not called The Abolitionist anymore. It's called Compassionate Living. And there's like a woman on the front with a cow. And gone are the messages to go vegan. Now it says go veg, try veg. That's what happens. These radical movements, once they turn professional, there's a price that has to be paid. Fine. You want to pay that price? Okay. But the creepy part is they turn around and start to reach out to students and try to indoctrinate them as well. And what ends up happening now is that we have this hegemonic block in the animal rights movement of all these major organizations that pretty much look the same. It's a term we call isomorphic. They just look the same. They act the same, and they can act as one powerful block and make it very difficult for anything radical to squeeze its way through. So with FARM, the Farm Animal Rights Movement organization, which hosts the largest animal rights conference in the United States every year, there's a long history, and I've documented this in my book as well, of them actively blocking radical speakers and radical groups from participating. And also their Animal Rights Hall of Fame. Who do you think gets in that Hall of Fame? Not the radicals. And by the way, not a lot of women either, because when I did was working on my content analysis, I looked and did a tally. How many women? Actually, it was like 2/3 of their Hall of Fame winners were men in a movement that's mostly women. So there you go. Gatekeeping. So this is what I think we should be thinking about, these larger systems, the role of capitalism, the role of these large organizations working in tune with each other, and how industry and state interests infiltrate into movements.
A lot of radical stuff happens at universities and with young people and with students. And there's a history of students kind of driving and facilitating change. And I think what you've pointed to there is really significant and important. What does it mean for the politics of achieving a better world for animals if those who are fighting on behalf of them are kind of co-opted within capitalist systems? So I think that's a really, really important point. Corey, do you have a quote ready for us? I know that you have a quote that you wanted to read to drive home some of your ideas.
So this comes from the first page of my second book, Piecemeal Protest, Animal Rights in the Age of Nonprofits, which basically talks about how factionalism is an everyday part of animal rights, and really, truly a major part of lots of social movement lives. But we don't like to talk about it because it seems quite personal. And sometimes I think, I think everybody in the movement who's been active has been in those situations where it does feel very personal. So this is how I start the book. Nothing personal. So sociology advances the radical idea that much of what individuals take to be real or common sense is actually socially constructed. That is, reality is only real in the collective imagination, and imaginations can be manipulated. And this is a radical idea that is already well accepted by many social movement activists who are keenly aware that reality can be manufactured, and they have a vested interest in contributing to that manufacture. Indeed, social movements hold great relevance to the social construction of reality, given their focus on meaning-making in the public sphere. Activists, however, may find themselves distracted by this potential for agency, focusing on their individual experience of social movement mobilization to the exclusion of the wider environment that contains it. It is certainly the powerful cultural ideology of individualism that encourages this misattribution of social or systemic processes to individual behaviors or bad luck. But sociology's structural focus lends to a depersonalization of politics. For activists embroiled in the distressing emotional labor of movement building and the inevitable disagreement that comes with group-level cooperation, sociological analysis should provide a critical understanding that relieves frustration and empowers. Infighting and boundary making are typical characteristics observed of collective behaviors across most, if not all, sectors. It is nothing personal. It is a predictable consequence of people coming together to do the messy business of constructing the social world.
That was wonderful. Thank you so much. And we haven't really spoken much about sociology here. I know that you mentioned at the beginning that you kind of fell into sociology, but you've been a big advocate for sociology and why it is so important to understanding animals' relations and to understanding the practice of veganism. And I know that you're one of the founders of the Vegan Feminist Network. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit here about why sociology is also so important to animal studies.
Yeah, I think that definitely comes from my experience as an activist. Is I'm familiar with a lot of this research, these theories, and I just don't see it in the movement. I think that it's really cool, for instance, that these vegan psychologists are now, finding a lot of space in the animal rights movement. A lot of that has to do with the fact that they can quantify stuff. That's nice for organizations, grant applications, let's be honest. But for us doing this movement stuff, like, it's astonishing to me. Like, there's this whole world of social movement research and sociological research that can tell us how to do our activism more effectively, what to watch out for, how to make predictions, how to avoid certain costs, how to weigh risks. That's there. But unfortunately, the animal rights movement has really leaned toward philosophy. Again, this very masculine, rational, sort of reasoned approach to thinking about animal ethics. And now, again, a new wave of, I would say, masculinized science coming from psychology, whereas sociology historically has been quite masculinized as well. But the sociology that we're using in animal rights spaces is very much so informed by feminism and takes intersectional, critical, radical approaches. And that, of course, pegs it as feminized, I would say. But one thing that a lot of folks really could do with in the animal rights movement is moving beyond that individual. That's really what sociology offers us, moving beyond the individual focus. It's not about so-and-so being hateful in the chat. It's not about how do we figure out individual personality characteristics so we can manipulate them and persuade them to go vegan. That's kind of on the margins. Sociology is asking us to think about, well, what are the systems and structures and institutions in place, and how do they inform our choices? How do they inform the options available to us? How does that inform the individual experience and the social experience? And that, I think, there's a whole lot of extra work that we could be doing in the animal rights movement. So that's one of the reasons me and Zoe Sutton co-founded the International Association for Vegan Sociologists back in 2020. And we've got a whole group of people now who are on board to start doing this important work. And most folks are coming out of the activist movement themselves. So they know what challenges need to be met. And I think that's one of the cool things that we're doing. We're not just sitting in our ivory towers, institutions, and our chairs thinking about things. We're actually activists ourselves. And we know the types of questions that are really poignant and need to be answered. So yeah, I think sociology, what we do is we push back on this focus on the individual. It's nothing personal. is so much more than that.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for everything you do. Before we say goodbye, could you tell us a little bit about what you're working on now? If I believe Twitter, there's some exciting stuff on the horizon for you. Could you tell us a little bit about what you're working on now? And if folks are interested in your work, as well as the Vegan Feminist Network, how can they get in touch?
Okay, thanks. I'll try to make it succinct. If you're interested in vegan sociology, go to vegansociology.com. We host an annual conference where we're so informed by feminism. Our last conference was titled, the theme was vegan intersectionality. So it was all kinds of feminist stuff. And that's open to students, scholars, independent study people, anyone. If you're interested in more specifically feminist stuff, yeah, check out veganfeministnetwork.com. I also run a Facebook page for that. The two big projects I have on the horizon are both feminist related. The first one is kind of a fun project where I'm looking at veganism and witchcraft. So kind of pulling on ecofeminism and how ecofeminism in the late 20th century had this a faction of witches, feminist witches, and then they have a faction of vegan feminists. And near between the two, was there any kind of interaction as far as I can tell, even though they were all working in the San Francisco Bay Area. So this is really interesting. But the idea is that, you know, it's now become a nature religion. We could talk forever on this, so I won't go into it. But it's a nature religion, feminist religion. So not even for some people, it's not even a religion at all. For me, it's just kind of like a lifestyle, if you will. But where do non-human animals actually fit into that story? There's a lot of so many things I could just for instance, because Halloween is coming up. Halloween being the Day of the Dead, Samhain. Samhain is where it used to be the big slaughter festival. And that may be one reason that it's very interesting that World Vegan Day is the day right after that. So when they were designing World Vegan Day, they took into consideration that, yes, there's all kinds of stuff to look into. That is going to be published with Routledge. I can go on and on. And I'm way in the middle of researching for that one right now, so I've got tons of good stuff. But the other one, and this is really like a lifetime in the making right here, is vegan feminism. I'm going to be writing a book on that for Bloomsbury, which also houses Carol Adams's work and the work of other vegan feminists. But this is going to be like a catch-all book, a go-to reference on vegan feminist thought, social movement theories. But I'm also hoping to introduce some archival research from the Marty Keel Archive, which is held, I think, at Harvard University. And also plan on doing some qualitative interviewing with some of the so-called mothers of the movement and maybe the daughters, if you will, the people who are holding the vegan feminist fort down in the 21st century. So yeah, there's lots of stuff on the horizon. Oh, and also my website, coreyleewren.com. Everything is there.
I don't know how you quite squeeze in the amount you do, because your website is jam-packed with blogs and you've been part of a podcast and, you know, you lead the Vegan Feminist Network. And now you've got two books on the horizon. It's incredibly exciting. And both of those, and they seem so different, but somehow related, right? Like your work. Yeah, like the idea of Halloween. I had no idea that Halloween was attached to mass slaughter at all. Like, you know, you think about it as the Day of the Dead, but somehow this always happens, particularly with history, is the more you look at anything, animals are there. They've always been there. They've shaped a lot of our traditions and our cultural practices. So I find that really fascinating, and I'm very excited to see your work there. And of course, vegan feminism, I think, based on what you've had to say here today, it's rich. There's a lot to be said. It's got a long and dynamic history, and it's got a lot to contribute to the future of animal rights and of veganism and of, I guess, the politics of animal and human relations. So thank you for everything you do, Corey. It's been amazing having you on the show today, and I look forward to seeing your stuff.
Oh, cheers. Thanks.
Virginia, I'm happy to have you back on the Animal Highlight. I'm looking forward to our conversation today because the chat with Corey was really so interesting, kind of feminism and social movement mobilization, a lot of words, but really interesting. So what's in store for us?
Yeah, it's really good to be back. Thank you. And I have got something really interesting to talk about today, or at least I think so. Yes. I talked about dogs for the first Animal Highlight of this season. And today I want to talk about one particular dog, Brown Dog, who was the dog at the heart of the Brown Dog Affair. There are two important things to say. The first and most important and perhaps most obvious is that this dog doesn't even seem to have had a name, or if he did, it wasn't used at the time of his story and it's now forgotten. So like others, I'm calling him Brown Dog. The second is that even his story is somewhat forgotten, despite its importance. I've lived in England and work in human-animal relations, but I hadn't heard about the brown dog affair until you told me about it while you were working on this episode about social movements. Brown Dog was a small brown stray terrier who somehow found himself in the hands of the medical school at the University College of London, where he was used for vivisection, which was still a common practice in 1903 when this story takes place, as physicians researched and taught anatomy and physiology. In some ways, Brown Dog was no different from the many, many other animals who undergo vivisection. He suffered as a result of the experiments he endured, but so do many other animals. The difference is that his suffering was witnessed by people opposed to vivisection and brought to the attention of the National Anti-Vivisection Society. I'd really like to be able to tell you more about Brown Dog himself, but I couldn't find anything recorded about him. What is recorded is the difference that he and his story made. So to tell you his story, I need to tell you about the people who captured it in 1903, and it links really well to what Corey Wren was talking about in terms of social movements in relation to animal rights and feminism. Brown Dog's story was brought to light by Lisa Schartauer and Louise Lindaff Hagby. Schartauer and Hagby were anti-vivisectionists from Sweden who had enrolled at University College London to record vivisection practices there. Just to make clear, vivisection's the performance of surgery on live animals for the purposes of research, as opposed to dissection, which is the performance of surgery on animals after their death. They kept notes on what they saw, including the vivisection of Brown Dog, and they presented them to a man called Stephen Coleridge, who was secretary of the National Anti-Vivisection Society. According to the National Anti-Vivisection Society, Coleridge noticed from Chateau and Hagby's notes that Brown Dog's vivisection was illegal. He'd been experimented on twice, although the Cruelty to Animals Act of 1876 stated that they could be experimented on only once, and he hadn't been killed directly after the experiments on him. Again, the Cruelty to Animals Act states that this has to happen. But because of the time which had already passed between Chateau and Hagby witnessing Brown Dog's vivisection and Coleridge becoming aware of it, he decided that a formal prosecution wouldn't be possible. Instead, he took what he thought was his only other option and publicly accused William Baylis, the man who had carried out the vivisection, of breaking the law and of cruelty amounting to torture.
Sorry, I just want to confirm that I understand exactly what's happening. So there were these two Swedish students who were at the Royal College of London, and they were anti-vivisectionists, and they reported that this dog had been operated on alive twice. And then Coleridge was a lawyer?
He was, actually. He was a barrister, but it's more in his role as secretary to the Anti-Vivisection Society.
I see. Okay. And then Baylis is the person who had done the operations, the vivisection. Okay. I'm with you.
The other thing I should say is that vivisection was legal, but it was controlled. And even though, you know, vivisection is done on live animals, they are anaesthetized, or Brown Dog was certainly supposed to be anaesthetized while the procedure was happening. But there were also questions about that. So it was a very complicated legal case. But the difficulty, partly for Coleridge, was that just too much time had gone by for him to be able to go through the formal legal channels. Anyone can make a public accusation if they have evidence. And so that's essentially what he did. He did have evidence from the two Swedish students, so he used that to make an accusation. But what happened was, you know, when he made that public accusation, Baylis essentially took it as defamation and sued Coleridge for defamation. So then this case, this defamation case, plays out in a trial which attracts a huge amount of public attention. And ultimately, Coleridge wasn't able to prove his accusations, and Baylis was awarded damages. By then, though, public opinion was firmly with Coleridge, and money was raised to cover the cost of the damages to Bayliss that Coleridge would otherwise have had to pay himself. But even once the case was settled, the story doesn't end. Because so much public sentiment had been aroused, the case wasn't easily forgotten. And in 1906, 3 years after the trial, a statue was erected to Brown Dog with the following inscription. I'm going to read you the inscription. In memory of the brown terrier dog done to death in the laboratories of University College in February 1903, after having endured vivisection extending over more than 2 months and having been handed over from one vivisector to another till death came to his release. Also in memory of the 232 dogs vivisected at the same place during the year 1902. Men and women of England, how long shall these things be? That inscription was on the statue. And what's really important here is that Brown Dog was remembered, but also remembered with him are the other dogs who'd shared his fate the year before. And his story really galvanised the anti-vivisection movement in Britain. And it's also important to note that the story of and around Brown Dog really escalated from here and became about more than Brown Dog himself. So it turned into the sort of social movement that you've just been talking about. So medical students from University College London objected to the fact that UCL was identified and singled out as performing vivisection, given that many other universities also did this at the time. And they repeatedly attempted to vandalise Brown Dog's memorial to the point that police were appointed to guard it around the clock. And from this point, the debate formed along class and gender divides, with upper-class medical students on one side and suffragettes who were closely aligned with anti-vivisectionists, trade unionists, working-class people who lived near the statue, and other groups forming an unlikely alliance on the other side. And protests and demonstrations for and against the statue and for and against vivisection, as well as other social movements, escalated and continued for years. And eventually, since the statue was seen as a catalyst for and a focus of the protests, it was removed in 1910. And instead, there's now a memorial to the original statue. The new statue still has the original inscription, but it's in a different place, and it's markedly different from the first statue, which commemorated Brown Dog. Brown Dog, though, is still remembered. And of course, the ethics of using animals in medical experiments is still very much debated.
You said the statue is different, or is it just that it's been moved? So there's a new statue, so that it wasn't just that the statue was removed or moved.
Yeah, so the statue was removed and was actually destroyed. It's thought it was melted down. And there is now a new statue, but it's not a replica.
Is it still just of one dog?
It is. And that's a bit controversial because the artist who created it modelled it on her own dog, which is Lovely. But she's presented him in a pose which is kind of described as responsive. He seems to be reacting to some unseen character. Whereas the original dog in the original statue was sitting very proudly, very maybe stoically, staunchly, it's described as defiant.
This is fascinating. Yeah, the politics of statues, I think, is really, really interesting because they act as memorials, but they're like impassioned with a lot of meaning. You know, I think in recent years we've seen how passionately people feel about statues and what they represent. But I really do enjoy the story because my PhD looked at forgotten histories. And I think that this is quite interesting because how do you tell the story of animals that aren't remembered, right? That have no traces left of them. Are their stories insignificant? Are they unimportant? I would say not. And I really love that inscription included the numerous other dogs and that, you know, Brown Dog is just one of many dogs who was made visible to history because of these two Swedish students who reported it. So it's really a fascinating example. And of course, it raises all of these questions about animals in laboratories. What is experimentation for? Do you know if vivisection is still practiced today?
It is. And, you know, talking of those other dogs that were remembered on the statue, the numbers are huge. I found them for the USA and for Britain, they are a little bit different in terms of the stats that are available. So in 2021, there were 50,000 dogs in labs in the US, and then slightly different statistic for the UK. But the year before, in 2020, there were 4,340 experiments conducted on dogs in the UK. So, but that might mean there were actually slightly fewer dogs. Some dogs might have had more than one experiment conducted on them, but the numbers are huge.
They are, and the language here is really important, because experiments are one thing and research is another. So just because, you know, experiments are being done on some dogs, it doesn't mean that there aren't many other dogs being involved in research experiments, right? Because the language is, it's quite fascinating to see how the populations of animals change depending on if you only look at experimentation versus experimentation and research. Another really fascinating thing about how dogs, and I think one of the reasons why dogs became a kind of preferred species in laboratories, is because there's this interesting connection between stray dogs being taken in by, not sanctuaries, shelters, that's the word, stray dogs being taken in by shelters and them not knowing what to do. And there was an economy, a direct economy between shelters and universities. And I found evidence of this actually happening at my own university. The histories of it are really quite interesting in terms of where do these dogs come from? How do they end up in the universities in 1903? And even today, how do dogs end up in labs today? And I think it's a lot more organized. I think specific dogs are bred for specific experiments, if I'm not mistaken.
I know beagles are particularly favored for experiments because of their size and their temperament. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if they were specifically bred for experimentation. Although dogs are used, there are also a huge amount of primates used in laboratories and a huge amount of mice.
Yeah, I mean, next to mice, dogs and macaques and chimps, their numbers are negligible, right? And it's not about just comparing numbers. All of these animals experience what they're going through. But the scale at which mice and rats are included in laboratories is just absolutely staggering. And the ways in which they're bred to have specific diseases so that specific types of experiments can be done on them, the level of thinking and thought that goes into breeding very specific types. And again, this is where Thomas Harting, I remember him saying, we're not 70 kilogram rats. The idea that we can somehow emulate all of our health and our ideas from what rats do, but then in every other situation, we're like, no, humans are special. But when it comes to medicine, we're like, you know, no, we're going to test on rats, because that's, and the transferal rate of how successful these experiments are for actually bringing about a medicine is dismal. It's ridiculously low. But anyway, Brown Dog has done it again and sparked up conversation about the importance of having conversations about animal experimentation. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
Thank you to Corey Lee Wren for being an amazing guest, to Christian Mentz for editing this episode, to Animals in Philosophy, Politics, Law and Ethics, Apple for sponsoring this podcast, to Jeremy John for the logo and Gordon Clark for the bed music. This is The Animal Turn with me, Claudia Hertzenfelder.
For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. That's IROARPOD.com.